to create agony, to blacken the soul, to turn pure motives to filth, and love to lust, and then to hate, to turn a source of joy to a source of torture. That is what we exist for. His voice rang out. I shall go forth into the mundane world. I will strip the memories of those close to the Daylighter. They will remember him only as mortal. They will not remember Clary at all.
No, Clary shouted, and Asmodeus threw his head back and laughed, a dazzling laugh that made her remember that he had once been an angel.
You can't take our memories, said Isabel furiously. When Nephilim, it would be tantamount to an attack. The clay w-
Your memories you may keep, said Asmodeus. Nothing about your remembering Simon will get me in trouble with the Clave. And besides, it will torment you, which only doubles my pleasure. He grinned. I shall rip a hole through the heart of your world, and when you feel it, you will think on me and remember me. Remember.
Asmodeus pulled Simon close, his hand sliding up to press against Simon's chest, as if he could reach up through his ribcage into his heart.
We begin here. Are you ready, Daylighter?
Stop!
Isabel stepped forward, her whip in hand, her eyes burning.
We know your name, demon. Do you think I'm afraid to slay even a prince of hell? I would hang your head on my wall like a trophy, and if you dare touch Simon, I will hunt you down. I will spend my life hunting you.
Alec wrapped his arms around his sister and held her tightly.
Isabel, he said quietly, no.
What do you mean, no? Clary demanded. We can't let this happen. Jace!
This is Simon's choice.
Jace stood stock still. He was ashy pale, but unmoving. His eyes were locked on Simon's.
We have to honor it.
Simon looked back at Jace and inclined his head. His gaze was moving slowly over all of them, flicking from Magnus to Alec, to Jace, to Isabel, where it stopped and rested, and was so full of broken possibilities that Clary felt her own heart break. And then his gaze moved to Clary, and she felt the rest of her shatter. There was so much in his expression, so many years of so much love, so many whispered secrets and promises and shared dreams. She saw him reach down, and then something bright arced through the air toward her. She reached up and caught it reflexively. It was the golden ring Clary had given him. Her hand tightened around it, feeling the bite of metal against her palm, welcoming the pain.
Enough, said Asmodeus. I hate goodbyes.
And he tightened his grip on Simon. Simon gasped, his eyes flying wide open. His hand went to his chest.
My heart,
he gasped, and Clary knew from the look on his face, that it had started beating again. She blinked against her tears as a white mist exploded up around them. She heard Simon cry out in pain. Her own feet moved without volition and she ran forward, only to be hurled back as if she had struck an invisible wall. Someone caught her. Jace, she thought. There were arms around her, even as the mist circled Simon and the demon like a small tornado, half blocking them from view. Shapes began to appear in the mist as it thickened. Clary saw herself and Simon as children, holding hands, crossing a street in Brooklyn. She had barrettes in her hair, and Simon was adorably rumpled, his glasses sliding off his nose. There they were again, throwing snowballs in Prospect Park, and at Luke's farmhouse, tanned from summer, hanging upside down from tree branches. She saw them in Java Jones, listening to Eric's terrible poetry, and on the back of a flying motorcycle as it crashed into a parking lot, with Jace there looking at them, his eyes squinted against the sun. And there was Simon with Isabel, his hands curved around her face, kissing her, and she could see Isabel as Simon saw her, fragile and strong, and so, so beautiful. And there was Valentine's ship, Simon kneeling on Jace, blood on his mouth and shirt, and blood at Jace's throat. And there was the cell in Idris, and Hodge's weathered face, and Simon and Clary again. Clary etching the mark of Cain onto his forehead. Maureen, and her blood on the floor, and her little pink hat, and the rooftop in Manhattan where Lilith had raised Sebastian, and Clary was passing him a gold ring across a table, and an angel was rising out of a lake before him, and he was kissing Isabel. All Simon's memories, his memories of magic, his memories of all of them, being drawn out and spun into a skein. It shimmered, as white gold as daylight. There was a sound around all of them, like a gathering storm, but Clary barely heard it. She reached her hands out, beseeching, though she didn't know who she was begging.
Please.
She felt Jace's arms tighten around her, and then the edge of the storm caught her. She was lifted up, whirled away. She saw the stone room recede into the distance at a terrible speed, and the storm took her cries for Simon and turned them into a sound like the ragged tearing of wind. Jace's hands were torn from her shoulders. She was alone in the chaos, and for a moment she thought Asmodeus had lied to them after all, that there was no gateway, and that they would float in this nothingness forever until they died. And then the ground came up, fast. She saw the floor of the Accords Hall, hard marble veined with gold, before she hit it. The collision was hard, rattling her teeth. She rolled automatically, as she had been taught, and came to a stop at the side of the mermaid fountain in the center of the room. She sat up and looked around. The room was full of utterly silent, staring faces, but they didn't matter. She wasn't looking for strangers. She saw Jace first. He had landed in a crouch, poised to fight. She saw his shoulders relax as he looked around, realizing where they were, that they were in Idris, and the war was over. And there was Alec. He had his hand still in Magnus's. Magnus looked sick and exhausted, but he was alive. And there was Isabel. She had come through the closest to Clary, only a foot or so away. She was already on her feet, her gaze scanning the room once, twice, a desperate third time. They were all there, all of them. All, except one. She looked down at Clary. Her eyes were shining with tears.
"Simon's not here," she said. "He's really gone."
The silence that had held the assembly of shadow hunters in its grip seemed to break like a wave. Suddenly there were Nephilim running toward them. Clary saw her mother and Luke, Robert and Maris, Aline and Helen, even Emma Carstairs moving to surround them, to embrace them, and to heal them and help them. Clary knew they meant well, that they were running to the rescue, but she felt no relief. Her hand tightening on the gold ring in her palm, she curled up against the floor, and finally, allowed herself to cry.
24. Call it peace. "Who stands then to represent the fairy courts?" said Gia Penhallow. The Hall of Accords was draped with the blue banners of victory. They looked like pieces cut out of the sky. Each was stamped with a golden rune of triumph. It was a clear winter day outside, and the light that poured through the windows shimmered across the long lines of chairs that had been set up facing the raised dais at the center of the room, where the consul and the inquisitor sat at a long table. The table itself was decorated with more gold and blue. Massive golden candlesticks that nearly obscured Emma's view of the Downworlders, who also shared the table. Luke, representing the werewolves, a young woman named Lily, representing the vampires, and the very famous Magnus Bane, the representative for the warlocks. No seat had been placed at the table for a representative of Faerie. Slowly, from among the seated crowd, a young woman rose to her feet. Her eyes were entirely blue with no white. Her ears pointed like Helen's. "I am Kaylee Whitewillow," she said. "I will stand for the Seely Court." "But not for the Unseely," said Gia, her pen hovering above a scroll of paper. Kaylee shook her head, her lips pressed together. A murmur ran through the room. For all the brightness of the banners, the mood in the room was tense, not joyful. In the row of seats in front of the Blackthorns sat the Lightwoods. Maris with her back ramrod straight, and beside her, Isabel and Alec, their dark heads bent together as they whispered. Jocelyn Fairchild sat beside Maris, but there was no sign anywhere of Clary Frey or Jace Lightwood. "The Unseely Court declines a representative," said Gia, noting it down with her pen. She looked at Kaylee over the rims of her glasses. What word do you bring us from the Seely Court? Do they agree to our terms? Emma heard Helen at the end of her row of seats take a deep breath. Drew and Tavi and the twins had been considered too young to come to this meeting. Technically, no one under 18 was allowed, but special conditions had been made for those, like her and Julian, who had been directly affected by what was coming to be called the Dark War. Kayleen moved along the aisle between the row of seats and began to walk towards the dais. Robert Lightwood rose to his feet. "You must ask permission to approach the consul," he said in his gravelly voice. "Permission is not given," said Gia tightly. "Stay where you are, Kaylee White Willow. I can hear you perfectly well." Emma felt a sudden brief burst of pity for the fairy girl. Everyone was staring at her with eyes like knives. Everyone except Aline and Helen, who sat pressed close together. They were holding each other's hands and their knuckles were white. "The fairy court asks for your mercy," Kaylee said, clasping her slim hands in front of her. "The terms you have set down are too harsh. The fairies have always had their own sovereignty, our own kings and queens. We have always had warriors. We are an ancient people. What you ask for will crush us completely." A low murmur ran around the room. It was not a friendly noise. Gia picked up the paper lying on the table in front of her. "Shall we review?" she said. "We ask that the fairy courts accept all responsibility for the loss of life and damage sustained by Shadowhunters and Downworlders in the Dark War. The fair folk shall be responsible for the costs of rebuilding broken wards, for the re-establishment of the Praetor Lupus on Long Island, and the rebuilding of what in Alicante has been destroyed. You will spend your own riches upon it. As for the Shadowhunters taken from us, if you mean Mark Blackthorne, he was taken by the Wild Hunt," Kaylee said. "We have no jurisdiction over them. You will have to negotiate with them yourselves, though we will not prevent it." "He was not all that was taken from us," said Gia. "There is that for which there could be no reparation, the loss of life sustained by Shadowhunters and Lycanthropes in battle, those who were torn from us by the Infernal Cup." "That was Sebastian Morgenstern, not the corpse," Kaylee protested. "He was a Shadowhunter. And that's why we are not punishing you with a war that you would inevitably lose," said Gia coldly. "Instead, we insist merely that you disband your armies, that there be no more fair folk warriors. You may no longer bear arms. Any fairy found carrying a weapon without a dispensation from the Clave will be killed on sight." "The terms are too severe," Kaylee protested. "The fair folk cannot abide under them. If we are weaponless, we cannot defend ourselves." "We will put it to a vote then," said Gia, setting her paper down. "Any not in favor of the terms set down for the fair folk, please speak now." There was a long silence. Emma could see Helen's eyes roving the room, her mouth pinched at the sides. Aline was holding her wrist tightly. Finally, there was the sound of a chair scraping back, echoing in the silence, and one lone figure rose to his feet. Magnus Bane. He was still pale from his ordeal in Eden, but his gold-green eyes burned with an intensity that Emma could see from across the room. "I know that mundane history is not of enormous interest to most Shadowhunters," he said. "But there was a time before the Nephilim, a time when Rome battled the city of Carthage, and over the course of many wars was victorious. After one of the wars, Rome demanded that Carthage pay them tribute, that Carthage abandon their army, and that the land of Carthage be sowed with salt. The historian Tacitus said of the Romans that they make a desert and call it peace." He turned to Gia. "The Carthaginians never forgot. Their hatred of Rome sparked another war in the end, and that war ended in death and slavery. That was not peace. This is not peace." At that, there were catcalls from the assembly.
"Perhaps we don't want peace, Warlock," someone shouted. "What's your solution, then?" someone else shouted.
"Leniency," said Magnus. "The fair folk have long hated the Nephilim for their harshness. Show them something other than harshness, and you will receive something other than hate in return."
Noise burst out again, louder than ever this time. Gia raised a hand and the crowd quieted. "Does anyone else speak for the fair folk?" she asked. Magnus, taking his seat again, glanced sideways at his fellow Downworlders. But Lily was smirking and Luke was staring down at the table with a fixed look on his face. It was common knowledge that his sister had been the first taken and endarkened by Sebastian Morgenstern, that many of the wolves in the Praetor had been his friends, including Jordan Kyle, and yet there was doubt on his face. "Luke," Magnus said in his soft voice that somehow managed to echo through the room. "Please." The doubt vanished. Luke shook his head grimly. "Don't ask for what I can't give," he said. "The whole Praetor was slaughtered, Magnus. As the representative of the werewolves, I cannot speak against what they all want. If I did, they would turn against the Clave and nothing would be accomplished by that."
"There it is, then," Gia said. "Speak, Kaylee White Willow. Will you agree to the terms, or will there be a war between us?"
The fairy girl bowed her head.
"We agree to the terms."
The assembly burst into applause. Only a few did not clap. Magnus, Thoreau of Blackthorns, the Lightwoods, and Emma herself. She was too busy watching Kaylee as the fairy sat down. Her head might have been bowed submissively, but her face was full of a white-hot rage.
"So it is done," said Gia, clearly pleased. "Now we move to the subject of..."
"Wait." A thin shadow hunter with dark hair had risen to his feet. Emma didn't recognize him. He could have been anyone, a Cartwright, a Pommercy.
"There remains the question of Mark and Helen Blackthorne."
Helen's eyes closed. She looked like someone who had been half expecting a guilty sentence in a trial and half hoping for a reprieve. And this was the moment after the guilty sentence had fallen. Gia paused, her pen in her hand.
"What do you mean, Balog?"
Balog drew himself up.
"There's already been discussion of the fact that Morgenstern's forces penetrated the Los Angeles Institute so easily. Both Mark and Helen Blackthorne have the blood of fairies in them. We know the boy's already joined up with the Wild Hunt, so he's beyond us. But the girl shouldn't be among Shadow Hunters. It isn't decent."
Aline shot to her feet.
"That's ridiculous," she spat. "Helen's a Shadow Hunter. She's always been one. She's got the blood of the angel in her. You can't turn your back on that."
"And the blood of fairies," said Balog. "She can lie. We've already been tricked by one of her sort to our sorrow. I say we strip her marks."
Luke brought his hand down on the table with a loud slam. Magnus was hunched forward, his long-fingered hands covering his face, his shoulders slumped.
"The girl's done nothing," Luke said. "You can't punish her for an accident of birth."
"Accidents of birth make us all what we are," said Balog stubbornly. "You can't deny the fairy blood in her. You can't deny she can lie. If it comes down to a war again, where will her loyalty stand?"
Helen got to her feet. "Where they stood this time," she said. "I fought at the Burren and at the Citadel and in Alicante to protect my family and protect Nephilim. I've never given anyone reason to question my loyalty."
"This is what happens," Magnus said, raising his face. "Can't you see this is how it begins again?"
"Helen is right," said Gia. "She's done nothing wrong."
Another Shadow Hunter rose to her feet, a woman with dark hair piled on her head.
"Begging your pardon, Consul, but you are not objective," she said. "We all know of your daughter's relationship with the fairy girl. You should recuse yourself from this discussion."
"Helen Blackthorne is needed, Mrs. Sedgwick," said Diana Rayburn, standing. She looked outraged. Emma remembered her in the Accords Hall, the way she had tried to get to Emma to help her. "Her parents have been murdered. She has 5 younger brothers and sisters to care for."
"She is not needed," snapped Sedgwick. "We are reopening the academy. The children can go there or they can be split up among various institutes."
"No," Julian whispered, his hands were in fists on his knees.
"Absolutely not," Helen shouted. "Gia, you must..."
Gia met her eyes and nodded, a slow, reluctant nod.
"Arthur Blackthorne," she said, "please rise."
Emma felt Julian beside her freeze in shock as a man on the other side of the room, hidden among the crowd, rose to his feet. He was slight, a paler, smaller version of Julian's father, with thinning brown hair and the Blackthorne eyes, half hidden behind spectacles. He leaned heavily on a wooden cane, with a discomfort that made her think the injury that required the cane was recent.
I wish to wait until after this meeting that the children might meet their uncle properly, Gia said. I summoned him immediately on news of the attack on the Los Angeles Institute, of course, but he had been injured in London. He arrived in Idris only this morning. She sighed. Mr. Blackthorne, you may introduce yourself. The man had a round, pleasant face and looked extremely uncomfortable being stared at by so many people. I am Arthur Blackthorne, Andrew Blackthorne's brother, he said. His accent was British. Emma always forgot that Julian's father had originally come from London. He had lost his accent years before. I will be moving into the Los Angeles Institute as soon as possible and bringing my nieces and nephews with me. The children will be under my protection. Is that really your uncle? Emma whispered, staring. Yes, that's him, Julian whispered back, clearly agitated. It's just, I was really starting to think he wouldn't come. I'd rather have Helen look after us. Well, I'm sure we're all immeasurably relieved that you'll be looking after the Blackthorne children, said Luke. Helen is one of them. Are you saying, by claiming responsibility for the younger siblings, that you agree that her mark should be stripped? Arthur Blackthorne looked horrified. Not at all, he said. My brother may not have been wise in his dalliances, but all records show that the children of Shadowhunters are Shadowhunters. As they say, ut incepit fidelis sic permanet. Julian slid down in his seat. More Latin, he muttered, just like Dad. What does it mean? Emma asked. She begins loyal and ends loyal, something like that. Julian's eyes flicked around the room. Everyone was muttering and glaring. Gia was in muted conference with Robert and the Downworld representatives. Helen was still standing, but it looked as if Aline was all that was holding her up. The group at the dais broke apart, and Robert Lightwood stepped forward. His face was thunderous. So that there is no discussion that Gia's personal friendship with Helen Blackthorne will have influenced her decision, she has recused herself, he said. The rest of us have decided that, as Helen is 18, at the age where many Shadowhunters are posted to other institutes to learn their ways, she will be posted to Wrangell Island to study the wards. For how long? Said Balog immediately. Indefinitely, said Robert, and Helen sank down into her chair. Aline at her side, her face a mask of grief and shock. Wrangell Island might have been the seat of all the wards that protected the world, a prestigious posting in many ways, but it was also a tiny island in the frozen Arctic Sea north of Russia, thousands of miles from Los Angeles. Is that good enough for you? Gia said in a cold voice. Mr. Balog? Mrs. Sedgwick? Should we vote on it? All in favor of assigning Helen Blackthorne to a posting on Wrangell Island until her loyalty is determined, say aye. A chorus of aye and a quieter chorus of nay ran around the room. Emma said nothing, and neither did Jules. Both of them were too young to vote. Emma reached her hand over and took Julian's, squeezed it tightly. His fingers were like ice. He had the look of someone who had been hit so many times that they no longer even wanted to get up. Helen was sobbing softly in Aline's arms. There remains the question of Mark Blackthorne, said Balog. What question? Demanded Robert Lightwood, sounding exasperated. The boy has been taken by the Wild Hunt in the unlikely event that we are able to negotiate his release. Shouldn't this be a problem to worry about then? That's just it, said Balog. As long as we don't negotiate his release, the problem takes care of itself. The boy is likely better off with his own kind anyway. Arthur Blackthorne's round face paled. No, he said. My brother wouldn't have wanted that. He'd have wanted the boy at home with his family. He gestured toward where Emma and Julian and the rest were sitting. They've had so much taken away from them. How can we take more? We're protecting them, snapped Sedgwick. From a brother and sister who will only betray them as time passes and they realize their true loyalty to the courts. All in favor of permanently abandoning the search for Mark Blackthorne, say aye. Emma reached to hold Julian as he hunched forward in his chair. She clung awkwardly to his side. All of his muscles were rigid, as hard as iron, as if he were readying himself for a fall or a blow. Helen leaned toward him, whispering and murmuring, her own face streaked with tears. As Aline reached past Helen to stroke Jules' hair, Emma caught sight of the blackthorn ring sparkling on Aline's finger. As the chorus of I went around the room in a terrible symphony, the gleam made Emma think of the shine of a distress signal far out at sea, when no one could see it, where there was no one to care. If this was peace and victory, Emma thought, maybe war and fighting was better after all. Jay slid from the back of the horse and reached up a hand to help Clary down after him. Here we are, he said, turning to face the lake. They stood on a shallow beach of rocks facing the western edge of Lake Lynn. It was not the same beach where Valentine had stood when he had summoned the angel Raziel. Not the same beach where Jace had bled his life out and then regained it. But Clary had not been back to the lake since that time, and the sight of it still sent a shiver through her bones. It was a lovely place, there was no doubt about that. The lake stretched into the distance, tinted with the color of the winter sky, limned in silver, the surface brushed and rippled so that it resembled a piece of metallic paper folding and unfolding under the wind's touch. The clouds were white and high, and the hills around them were bare. Clary moved forward, down to the edge of the water. She had thought her mother might come with her, but at the last moment Jocelyn had refused, saying that she had bidden goodbye to her son a long time ago, and that this was Clary's time. The Clave had burned his body, at Clary's request. The burning of a body was an honor, and those who died in disgrace were buried at crossroads, whole and unburned, as Jace's mother had been. The burning had been more than a favor, Clary thought. It had been a sure way for the Clave to be absolutely certain that he was dead. But still, Jonathan's ashes were never to be taken to the abode of the Silent Brothers. They would never form a part of the City of Bones. He would never be a soul among other Nephilim souls. He would not be buried among those he had caused to be murdered. And that, Clary thought, was only fair and just. The Andarkand had been burned, and their ashes buried at the crossroads near Brosland. There would be a monument there, an acropolis to recall those who had once been shadow hunters. But there would be no monument to recall Jonathan Morgenstern, whom no one wanted to remember. Even Clary wished she could forget, but nothing was that easy. The water of the lake was clear, with a slight rainbow sheen to it like a slick of oil. It lapped against the edges of Clary's boots as she opened the silver box she was holding. Inside it were ashes, powdery and grey, flecked with bits of charred bone. Among the ashes lay the Morgenstern ring, glimmering in silver. It had been on a chain around Jonathan's throat when he had been burned, and it remained untouched and unharmed by the fire. I never had a brother, she said. Not really. She felt Jace place his hand on her back between her shoulder blades. You did, he said. You had Simon. He was your brother in all the ways that matter. He watched you grow up, defended you, fought with and for you, cared about you all your life. He was the brother you chose. Even if he's gone now, no one and nothing can take that away from you. Clary took a deep breath and flung the box as far as she could. It flew far, over the rainbow water, black ashes arcing out behind it like the plume of a jet plane. And the ring fell along with it, turning over and over, sending out silver sparks as it fell and disappeared beneath the water. Awe atque wale, she said, speaking the full lines of the ancient poem. Awe atque wale in perpetuum frater. Hail and farewell forever, my brother. The wind off the lake was cold. She felt it against her face, icy on her cheeks. And only then did she realize that she had been crying, and that her face was cold because it was wet with tears. She had wondered since she had found out that Jonathan was alive why her mother had cried on the day of his birth every year. Why cry if she hated him? But Clary understood now. Her mother had been crying for the child she would never have, for all the dreams that had been wrapped up in her imagination of having a son, her imagination of what that boy would be like. And she'd been crying for the bitter chance that had destroyed that child before he had ever been born. And so, as Jocelyn had for so many years, Clary stood at the side of the mortal mirror and wept for the brother she would never have, for the boy who had never been given the chance to live. And she wept as well for the others lost in the dark war, and she wept for her mother and the loss she had endured, and she wept